like to thank the organizers for inviting me here, even though this wasn't the title I would have chosen myself. But nonetheless, I'll try to stick to it as far as covering the first two topics, which are the topics they gave me, but I think more importantly for this group is how perhaps they tie in with the solar magnetic cycle. I'm going to cover a little bit. In fact, I'm going to start off touching on points that Doug already went over in the last talk, and I'm going to end up touching on points that Peter gave in the first talk. And in between, I'm actually going to do what the organizers wanted me to do, which is to talk about meridional flow and the torsional oscillations. So to begin, I want to talk about a few of the features, observed features of the sun that need to be explained by any dynamo theory. The first one is just this 11-year period for the sunspot cycle. It's also called the Wolf cycle, but it was discovered by Schwabe in 1844. In addition to the 11-year part, you can see that the cycles are asymmetric. Typically, they have a fast rise to maximum and a slower decline. And there's also an effect called the Vollmeyer effect, where big cycles tend to get to maximum in less time than smaller cycles. And then, of course, there's the variability from cycle to cycle in amplitude, and the fact that we've had this thing called a modern minimum and presumably other things like it in the past where the sun just stops producing sunspots for a while. So again, another feature of any dynamo model that a dynamo model would need to reproduce. There's the migration of sunspots to lower latitudes, called Spohrer's Law, but discovered by Carrington. And it's basically that sunspots first appear at the mid-latitudes in two bands, spread out to higher and lower latitudes, and then that band drifts towards the equator over the course of the solar cycle. And as Doug mentioned, they do overlap. You could see that many, many cycles ago. In fact, the cycles overlap at minimum. You get spots at the high latitude from one cycle. At the same time, you have spots from the old cycle near the equator. So again, need to explain this latitude drift. Another aspect is Joy's Law. Again, Joy's Law, but discovered by Hale. Although I guess Joy probably was involved in that, was he not? Yes. Yeah. And again, the basic idea, as Doug said, is that sunspots or spot groups are tilted with respect to the lines of constant latitude, and the angle of that tilt increases with latitude from basically zero at the equator to a few degrees at higher latitudes. Next thing to be explained, Hale's polarity law, amazingly discovered by Hale instead of someone else, and this is that the polarity of preceding spots in the northern hemisphere, so again here yellow being positive polarity or out of the sun, is opposite to the polarity of the preceding spots in the southern hemisphere, and that polarity flips from one cycle to the next. So this is peak of cycle 21 about 1980, peak of cycle 22 around 1990. And this diagram, the magnetic butterfly diagram, this is kind of the key to many dynamo models, is you want to be able to reproduce this pattern on the surface. What I've done here is taken the Kitt Peak magnetograms, synoptic maps, and take the average magnetic flux on at a given latitude in longitude, and then plot it as a function of latitude and time for all the Carrington rotations since about 1975. You can see Hale's law and Joy's law in here. You can see that if you look at the wings of the butterfly diagram, that the poleward part is one polarity, the equatorward part is the opposite, and it's the opposite sense in the other hemisphere. You can see the latitude drift in the active regions. More importantly, when you look at magnetic field, is you can see what's happening in the polar regions as well. And Babcock noted that, in fact, the fields reverse at about the time of sunspot maximum. You can also see on this, in fact, evidence of meridional flow in this, that you see this apparent streaming of matter that is a function of time. It's moving, different polarities are moving towards the poles from the sunspot latitudes, and you know, it's obvious to me when I see this that you know this is the source of this meridional flow is the source of the reversal of the magnetic field, that you've got the poleward sides of these butterflies moving off towards the poles and eventually giving you enough flux at the pole that it reverses at about the time of maximum. In order to do that, you need some cancellation of flux at lower latitudes across the equator, where the polarity in the north and the polarity in the south are opposite, and need to somehow diffusively cancel out. Yes?
Do you know the velocity that you would get out of just measuring the slope of those rushes to the poles? Is that the 10 meters per second, or is it something else?
It's on that order. You can see places here where some places where it looks steeper than that, and other places where it's less steep. But I think, and again, I haven't measured it myself. I know people have, but I forget the exact numbers, other than I think they're within the ballpark of what people see for other meridional flows on the surface. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Pardon me? Where is the carpet field? It's averaged over in all of this. You don't see that aspect of it here. But just a second. Bob? Certainly you see cross-equatorial loops and things like that, but actual seeing flux disappear by opposite polarity elements, I mean, certainly right at the equator, you see it all the time in supergranules, but whether it's being transported there diffusively to do that, I don't know. It turns bright yellow well before you get to 40, if you look on the diagram over here. Yeah. You know, I bumped that just so you could see, in fact, the polar fields. Otherwise, yeah, they look really weak, and it's not quite as exciting. Okay. This is a movie, and I guess I can start it now. Showing Kitt Peak magnetograms, and again, they take magnetograms on a daily basis. From that, you can pull off a strip, make a synoptic map. Doug, you could have shown this.
Doug Lewis.
And this then is a function of time, what the magnetograms look like. And again, you can see the activity coming and going, starting at high latitudes, going towards the equator as you get to maximum. And as I said, it deserves repeated viewing. But the thing I want you to watch this time is the motions when the maps are animated, that you will see. You see differential rotation, stuff near the equator drifting off to the right, stuff near the poles drifting off to the left, and you'll see meridional flow, stuff streaming up out of the active regions off towards the poles. And right up. Okay, now the trick is to extend this to 2005. Okay. Again, Peter mentioned this before, but the two processes that you need to produce a dynamo. Again, these go back to Parker, probably earlier than that as well. One's the omega effect, where you need to wrap magnetic field lines around the sun. The differential rotation is such that you can take a field line, wrap around the sun in about 18 months. So over the course of a cycle, it gets wrapped several times. And then the alpha effect, you need to lift and twist these in a different sense, an even hemisphere, to reverse the sense of the poloidal field. So the external field here, the poloidal field, was going up outside the sun here. After they erupt here, it points downward, so you get a reversal of the field by having the combination of these two effects. David? Yes. There's another two effects. There's more. Yes. There's more. I said these are two of the effects that are needed. Again, Peter talked a bit about the history of this. It was long fought, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, at least, or early 80s, that all of this was done within the bulk of the convection zone. One problem with the bulk of the convection zone is that with the differential rotation and the helicity you get the dynamo waves going the wrong direction. The other problem is that there's too much helicity in the convective motions within the convection zone. That the turnover times for the large scale cells, Coriolis force working on them, twist things too much, basically. In the kinematic dynamos, this was treated by taking that alpha effect and squashing it by a huge amount. You dial it down by orders of magnitude, and then you can get a period that's about right. Even with the dynamic ones that Peter and Gary Glassmeyer and colleagues did, you ended up with shorter cycles. So the bulk of the convection zone was a problem. For the reasons Peter mentioned, good reasons to believe, in fact, that the dynamo largely occurs at the base of the convection zone in this interface layer, which is now been called the tachocline. That you need to be, you need to make very strong 10 to the 5 Gauss fields in order to get them to pop up at the right latitudes. And if they're that strong, they move through the convection zone way too fast, so you've got to put them down low to keep them there long enough that you can get the omega effect in particular to work on them. The other thing to note here is density change. There's this very rapid density change as you go into the convection zone. So many, many, many scale heights here right near the surface. This is another problem with actually doing the dynamo models themselves. This is the internal rotation rate. Again, we've already seen. The latitudinal gradient that you see at the surface extends into the sun, almost constant on radius, in particular at the mid-latitudes, perhaps more on cylinders right here near the equator. Changes rapidly to the more constant rotation of the interior at the tachocline, so you get the shear at the base of the convection zone. All right, now to get into my real topic, this is an example of a Dopplergram from MDI where you see surface flows. It's dominated by the rotation itself as far as blue shifted on the eastern limb, red shifted on the western limb. It's also dominated by the cellular pattern of supergranulation. The various flows include, again, differential rotation and axisymmetric meridional flow, and you can measure them by a number of techniques, including direct Doppler imaging, feature tracking, or helioseismology. Those flows and their extensions into the interior are the key to producing a dynamo as far as the interplay between the flows and the magnetic field. Here's the flow components. And again, I'm going to start off by talking about Doppler measurements of surface flows. If you take out the solid body rotation, this is what the differential rotation looks like. It's a rapidly rotating equator, more slowly rotating or retrograde moving polar region. Meridional circulation appears to be about 20 meters per second towards the poles. We're pretty sure mass is conserved, so there should be a return flow at some place within the sun. And then there's the cellular convection. The meridional circulation itself has been real difficult to measure. First of all, because it's a small flow compared to all these others. Secondly, in particular, the Doppler signal is masked by other velocity signals, the convective blue shift in particular. And that's led to a number of apparently conflicting results over the years, from Beckers in 78 giving 40 meters a second to the pole. Tom always gets it right. And 20 meters a second towards the pole. Perez-Gardet, 20 meters a second the other direction. Anderson, 50 meters a second towards the pole at low latitudes, but an 80 meter a second. Equatorward at high latitudes, and then Snodgrass getting 10 meters a second towards the pole. So there was this quite a range of measurements, both in size and even direction. I looked at gong data with a technique I developed for, first of all, separating the meridional circulation into components by spherical harmonics. And so here's the first four, what they would look like on the surface in Doppler signal, and presumably what they look like inside the sun. Part of the problem is that in analyzing this, in the one signal you have to get rid of is the convective blue shift, which is removed by taking averages on annually about the center of the disk. And when, if you do that, if you remove that average, those patterns, the odd ones stay about the same, but the even numbered ones end up getting altered by removing that average. So in particular, the most important one, the one that represents flow from the equator all the way to the poles, ends up looking like this in Doppler signal. But knowing that, I can then go and look for that pattern within the Doppler signal to figure out the strength of that flow. As you see, as you go to higher order ones here, they aren't quite so severely impacted by that process. This is the results from gong data published in 96. And what I found was in late 92 and 93, there was a fairly strong meridional flow of on the order of 50 meters a second. Fairly regular one, again, towards the poles in each hemisphere. As we progressed on to 95, it decreased to closer to 20 meters a second, considerably more structure as well. I regret to say I haven't extended this up to the present to see if there's any sense in all of this. It's on my to-do list. But the point of all of this was that it appears that in the surface, the meridional circulation changes is time dependent, and that helps to explain all the different observations we saw before, that depending upon when you were looking at the sun, you might get something somewhat different. But all through this period, it's still basically a poleward flow from the equator, but again with some structure on it. If you look into the interior helioseismology, if you use the global modes, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get the meridional circulation out. So you need to do local helioseismology, where you look at patches and you can see whether the patch below you is moving poleward or equatorward. What was found, the earliest measurement I think is Giles et al., was again a poleward flow from the equator at about 20 meters per second near the surface. That's been extended into the interior with helioseismology, and what you see here is the equator, plus or minus 10 degrees, so it's, you know, as expected, zero at the equator. Goes up to, well, in this case, at 50 degrees for this, it was up to about 50 meters a second up here, but the surprising thing is that it seems constant is a function of depth. We're going into the sun, depth is in this direction. So here's the outer, I guess, 3% of the sun, and it doesn't seem to vary much with depth. That's been extended even deeper by members of the audience. This is a combination of MDI, which gets you closer to the surface here, and gong data of what the meridional flow is as a function of depth. And now, this is the data as a function of wavelength over L, or rather frequency over L. This is three different models for what the flow might be like as a function of depth. One is no flow at all the way to halfway through the convection zone. This is 15% of the way into the sun. One is a constant 10 meters a second, and then this curve is something with some structure, and those are reflected in the curves over here. You see the data is consistent with something like 10 meters a second constant halfway through the convection zone. Certainly, there's no indication in any of this data of it flipping over to being the opposite sign. So even down to about, halfway through the convection zone, we still don't see the return flow. That's a problem. Well, I'm not sure that's true.
It shows the equator was
This is Haber's early work, or is this more recent stuff? Again, I've seen recent ring diagrams that show much the same thing as far as 10, 20 meters a second off to the poles.
Shows more time. Let's do the cons.
I'll plead ignorance here. Well, I certainly see, yeah.
There's all kinds of structures.
The MDI data I've looked at in 96 does show at the very high latitudes in the north an equatorward flow.
Yeah, I think so. Huh.
Well,
does this graph agree with
density? Does it agree with the density profile? Well, the problem, in fact, if I can go on to the next slide, is that if you look at the density profile, or more to the point, how much mass there is below a given layer, as you go 15% of the way in, it's only a half a percent of the mass of the sun in that outer half of the convection zone. There's 2.5% of the mass of the sun in from there out. So you've got five times as much mass in the lower half as you have in the outer half. So if it turns around right there in the middle, which again, there's no evidence that it does so yet, but if it turns around right in the middle, then a poleward flow of 10 meters per second in the outer half of the convection zone gives you an equatorward flow of a fifth that, or about 2 meters a second throughout the bulk of the bottom. And the interesting thing is that 2 meters a second is about what you need to propagate sunspots from the mid-latitudes towards the equator over a solar cycle. So, I think it's more than coincidental. But the important thing is we need to make that measurement. How strong is the meridional flow deep in the convection zone? More importantly, how strong is the meridional flow in the tachocline to help us understand whether the meridional circulation plays a key role in determining the time scale for the solar cycle. This is from a dynamo model. The plots here are from a model by Dick Patty and Charbonneau in 99, where they've used a fairly reasonable differential rotation profile, meridional circulation with it turning around a little below the middle of the convection zone. They, in order to produce an alpha effect, they have a source region that they say is due to rising flux tubes twisting and giving you the alpha effect. Just due to the Coriolis force on the rising flux tubes. With that, they can get the time scale about right, using a reasonable meridional circulation. Butterflies with the lower latitude wings at least moving in the right direction, and find that the period is basically inversely proportional to the meridional circulation flow speed. So that the period of the cycle is in fact determined largely by the strength of the meridional circulation. So this is a model where at least the meridional circulation is in there. It was largely neglected in many of the earlier dynamo models, but again, recently there's been a spat of quite a few papers including it, and it does seem to, and it can give about the right period. So again, an indication that it may be a critical component of the dynamo. I'm going to switch now to the torsional oscillations. As I did with the meridional flow, you can also represent the differential rotation in terms of spherical harmonics. So here's the solid body rotation part. The components that are usually included are the solid body one and the next two odd components that are symmetric about the equator. This is from Gong data in 96. It's from 6 months worth of data. The dotted line here are the actual measurements of the rotation velocity as a function of latitude. The solid line is a polynomial fit through that. And this is one way of seeing the torsional oscillations, which are seen as small variations about that curve. This isn't the best way to do it, by the way, but it works. This is that signal during that time period in 95. What the torsional oscillations are regions of slightly slower and slightly faster than the smooth background flow. That if you sat at one latitude and watched it, it would look like you're moving prograde for a few years, and then you're moving retrograde for a few years. Hence the oscillation part of it. At the time of these observations, this is where the sunspots were, or this is the area of the sunspots. And you see, sunspots tend to occur about where the shear is enhanced by the torsional oscillations. Here's a color version of Roger's plot that Doug showed, and the top diagram is this residual signal, where what he's done is removed a profile. It's also been averaged in time, and that's really the way you need to see them, is rather than just taking a smooth profile at a given snapshot. Red is fast, and so you can see a fast rotating stream starting out at 30 degrees latitude, moving towards the equator. Likewise in the southern hemisphere, disappearing at the equator, and then another one appearing during the next cycle. This is magnetic fields, again average, similar to what I did with the Kitt Peak magnetograms, where you can see the butterflies, and again the sunspot latitudes tend to form, or sunspots tend to form right at the edge between the fast and slow, where the latitudinal shear is enhanced. So this is at the surface. This is just below the surface with gong measurements. And again, you see those same bands starting out at 40 degrees towards the equator. This is symmetric now about the equator. This is from the global modes, and so there's symmetry north and south. Again, you see the same things just below the surface. More importantly, you see the same thing extending deep into the sun, and this was a surprise to me, at least. Again, here's 1%. What's this? 8%, 14%, 16%. So here you're halfway through the convection zone, and you see that same pattern. It starts getting noisy as you get down there, but you see the pattern extending deep into the sun. Whoops! Actually, I had to go back. It's thinking about it. Again, it's definitely more than a superficial signal. And I guess my mind when it first came out was that it was all superficial, that it was just due to flux tubes, inactive regions coming through the surface, and them moving, basically dragging along material with them because they move at a different rotation rate. The fact that they extend through the sun, again, is another observation that will ultimately need to be explained by dynamo models in order to get that kind of behavior. Again, there were ideas back in the early 80s, right after torsional oscillations were discovered, for how they were formed, and it's basically Lorentz forces, or Maxwell stresses, on flux tubes moving through the convection zone. And this is a much more complicated diagram than I wanted. This is also from a paper by Roger Ulrich. Point is, this is the surface rotation rate here. The magnetic features rotate at a more rapid rate than the surface, so they're moving with respect to the surface. This is the peak of the internal rotation profile here, about 5% of the way in, so they're somewhat slower than that. Again, my suspicion, and I don't have models for it, but just suspicions that the source of the torsional oscillations is the rising flux tubes through the convection zone, and how they feed back on the flow, and the fact that they move relative to it. So again, I still conclude that the torsional oscillations are a symptom of the cycle rather than a source of it. And again, just to get to the buoyant flux tubes, this is also members of the audience. Again, it takes very strong magnetic fields in order to get the tubes to come out at low latitudes rather than high latitudes. As they rise, they have to go through the differential rotation, or the rotation that you see within the sun. So again, a tube is rising from here to the surface there, starts off feeling one rotation right here, going through a more rapid rotation, and then slow right near the pole. And so again, my suspicion is that it's because of that relative flow with respect to the background rotation that the torsional oscillations are produced. But I have no idea why they're phased the way they are. I was handed a paper just before I got up by Ruschmeichen, where they'd done studies as well throughout the bulk of the convection zone, finding that it's Maxwell stresses or Lorentz forces on the magnetic field that could produce a similar sort of thing. So, concluding, first of all, concerning the flows themselves, I think I'm quite convinced myself, at least, that the meridional flow is largely poleward from the equator at about 20 meters per second. It extends deep into the convection zone from the surface. The equatorward return flow could have a speed similar to that of the equatorward drift of the active latitudes, and this suggests a causal link between the two. Well, boy, that's an interesting spelling of flow. That's old English, isn't it? It's good. All right, I'll leave it. But again, that return flow hasn't been observed yet, and you know, if this really is the thing that determines the period of the cycle, it really needs to be measured. It isn't impossible, but it may take observing both sides of the sun at the same time. The torsional oscillation bands also display this equatorward flow and also extend deep into the sun. My suspicion is that they're likely due to the effects of magnetic flux tubes threading through the convection zone and rotating at a different rate than the plasma. As for conclusions concerning the solar dynamo, and this is my humble opinion, I think the important thing is that the toroidal fields are produced by shear in the zonal flow at the tachocline. There's still a question of whether it's the radial shear that's most important or the latitudinal shear. I think the production of the poloidal field is produced by the twist imparted by the Coriolis force on rising flux tubes. That is, they rise, they twist slightly, giving you Joy's law, and that's just what you need, a slight twist, not a huge twist. So again, and when I look at the surface magnetic field, and you can see Joy's law in the surface magnetic field and that opposite polarity being carried off to the pole. So again, transport of the magnetic flux by the meridional circulation and diffusion at the surface can give you the polar field reversals near maximum, and then transport of the magnetic flux by the meridional circulation at the tachocline back towards the equator could give you the equatorward drift of the active latitude belts and impose the 11-year period of the sunspot cycle. And with that, I thank you for your attention. Well, that's where you need some sort of cancellation between the different polarities on either side of the equator in order to produce that. Because if you just had both polarities pop up and both of them moved off towards the pole, you wouldn't get any net flux at the pole. So you've got to have diffusion and cancellation of flux. And one obvious place is that you've got opposite fluxes on either side of the equator. You've also got some opposite fluxes, of course, right there in the active region you're at. Well, but again, I've done exactly what George said, though.
It doesn't look as if there's a for some reason it looks to me as if the leading polarities somehow ignore the flow.
I don't think they ignore it.
Yeah, so if the leading polarities are stronger than the electromagnetic in the field strength. So maybe the direct force.
So the suggestion here, again, you do see the leading spots more compact than following spots, and that may be a part of it.
Hockey?
But of course.
The leading polarities are connected across the equator, whereas the column polarity is connected up towards the pole. So the leading polarities are dragged towards the equator.
Subsurface.
Yes.
Well, on the other hand, you don't see them being moved you don't see any real equatorward flow if you watch the movie. Right? It really looks like stuff's just streaming out of the latitudes towards the poles.
I think it's probably worth commenting that I think it's impossible for the Borealis circulation to actually move the toroidal field, 10 to the 10th Gauss toroidal field, in the time planet, close to the time planet, towards the equator. The energy doesn't work out. However, the Borealis circulation can move a weak colloidal field down there. And if it does that, then the shearing action of the differential rotation on that weak colloidal field can produce new flux, toroidal flux, at the leading edge. I think that's how it actually happens.
Not just taking the direct transport of the 10 to the 5th Gauss fields. It's dense stuff.
See all that, and it matters as an observation, but does it matter to the operation of the planet?
I think it matters, personally, I think it matters a lot more if there's transport of flux to apply to some close to the equator and get the energy. In fact, if you're relying upon the surface effect of the upper dynamic transport of the flux produced there by the poles, by the time it gets around that real situation back to the equator, most of it's gone. Get a very poor linkage between the hemispheres. In fact, you tend to get the wrong symmetry of the magnetic field above the equator. Whereas if you start it, you get your colloidal flux produced at the base, sweep it rather quickly to the equator, you get the right symmetry of the world.
I mean, you get a picture of it.
Yeah.
Which is more like the classical picture. And then things like transequatorial cancellation and subversion. That was very important for the original that time. Had to happen. Does it have to happen in the
kind of
model that
we're
now
doing?
Best ones,
yes. Some of the recent dynamo models actually require there to be a polar magnetic field conducted because the diffusion of magnetic field down to the planet is so inefficient. Yeah. Charbonneau and Claremont and Discovery have a model for the existence of conductor.
Right,
but without putting the perspective at the bottom, the fact is going to be the wrong symmetry. What can we learn from the fact that you level your variation of the frequencies that you've not seen at a low depth, not seen at a low frequency, but low level?
We see it as function. Hell, well, I don't know. I thought those frequency changes were all attributed to, you know, changes in basically the stiffness of the surface layers due to magnetic fields threading through them. Yeah. at the top. I think it's that the changes are bigger or bigger near the surface than they are inside, plus the modes are much more sensitive to things near the surface anyway. Sound spends more of its time there. Yeah, Gopal? Well, certainly you do see lots of trans-equatorial loops as far as direct connections of magnetic field between hemispheres. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure myself.
Yeah, maybe you have to look at the number change.
Mm-hmm. You've lost me. Oh, this is for the total flux. No. Well, this doesn't look like a random walk, certainly. as far as, you know, it really looks like stuff flowing off towards poles, and in the individual maps, you can see stuff apparently streaming out. Purely diffusive, not advective. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Well, they all similar polarity, though?
Pardon?
Are they all similar polarity?
You have to change the polarity.
Yeah.
So that means you have to have some kind of way to transport moving these fields toward the pole.
Mm-hmm.
And then you should, in the period of the change, you should see something. Dance of death.
Dance of death. Right.
This, I would think, would cause the fluxes to rise in the temporary height. Is there evidence of that?
Fine. Well, twisted as opposed to Joy's law? You mean an actual helicity within the field? I don't know. You're asking. Where's Dr. Helicity? He's here someplace. Dave Russ.
Well, sure.
There he is. There's. I'm stepping on clothes.
Okay. I want to reiterate the importance of confusion. And there is some sort of hidden confusion, whatever. Observers clearly say we see the diffusion and Bradford was observed. And theory says you must have turbine diffusion to drive this link through the diamond. So the confusion comes. I suggest not to use the word random walk, which refers to wandering of, you know, quark and so on. Differential rotation, alpha effect, velocity, and meridional circulation are large-scale law. And diffusion is also large scale phenomenon. It drives a large scale of people, nothing to do with small scale vitals in a sense. And I would like in your next talk to see the fusion on the list. Of course, it works together with meridional circulation and so on. And I suggest that a lot of people don't use
it's on the list.
anymore, although it's correct in some sense. Turbulent diffusion, because you have convection.
Yeah. Again, it's on my list.
That's the wrong question.
Just above it then, yeah.
Okay, so these are my questions.